Good morning, everyone. This is Pat Archambeau of Virtue Stent Limited. I want to welcome everyone to the virtual journal club presented through the auspices of the DIA, and we are very pleased today that we're doing a joint virtual journal club with the PSI, which is the statisticians in the pharmaceutical industry, headquartered over in Europe, and with lots of folks joining in from particularly the UK. We want to first start by thanking appropriate folks. We want to thank the DIA for hosting the phone series, particularly Mary Keller, who is manager of volunteer services, who has helped greatly in setting this up. And from the pharmaceutical statisticians in the pharmaceutical industry, Rhiannon Maudsley and Cleverly and Sarah Bray, and my virtual journal club colleagues from the DIA, Yifeng Chen and Guang Zheng, who have helped me to set this up. I want to encourage and have everybody join the DIA, and particularly the stat community, so you can get involved, and to join the statisticians in the pharmaceutical industry. It's good to have colleagues with which we can interact. We're very pleased to be able to do this through the auspices, but particularly pleased to be able to do, to be presenting a joint virtual journal club. Today, our first speaker is Daniel Walkland. In terms of a short bio, he earned a degree in business economics from the Free University of Berlin, and then subsequently earned a degree, a Master of Science, in medical biometry and biostatistics from Rupert Karls University in Heidelberg. He's held jobs related to statisticians in the pharmaceutical industry of increasing responsibility, and currently is at the Interdisciplinary Center for Clinical Trials in Mainz, at the Medical University in Mainz, Germany. Daniel?
Okay. So thank you, Ted, for the kind introduction. And thank you for the invitation to speak in this journal club and to present this paper. Welcome to the audience. And I would like to thank Meinhard Kieser, who had the idea for this project, who supervised the project, and who gave a lot of input for the publication for the paper. Okay, we can now switch to the next slide, number 2. And I want to give a short background, the motivation for the paper, and we're in a classical situation, very typical for the planning stage of clinical trials. We have a high uncertainty related to the parameters which we need to calculate the sample size, and in longitudinal clinical trials, this is even more complex because intra-subject correlation has to be estimated. And in our project, we focused on generalized estimating equations as one approach of analyzing longitudinal data. And we focused on internal pilot study designs. And this is the setting. And we want to get the chance to correct for initial misspecifications in the planning stage of a clinical trial. And the question is, the recalculation procedure feasible, and are the type 1 and 2 error probabilities preserved within such procedure? We can now switch to slide number 3, and there you see a generic display of a recalculation procedure in a fixed sample size design. It's very easy. At the beginning, you need to calculate the sample size. After this, you recruit the subjects needed, and in the end, data are analyzed. In a design with an internal pilot study, it's a little bit more complex because you have several additional steps. After sample size calculation, recruitment of the subjects needed for the internal pilot study is performed, and then, based on these internal pilot study data, selected parameters are re-estimated. And after this, based on these updated estimates, sample size is recalculated. And if this recalculated sample size exceeds the size of the internal pilot study, further subjects must be recruited, and in the end, data are analyzed. Now we can switch to slide number 4. And on this slide, the investigated setting for the simulation study we performed is displayed. So we are in a model with a continuous outcome variable, and then you have two intercepts. The first one is the intercept of the reference group, beta index 1, and beta 2 is the coefficient for the difference between the intercepts between two treatment groups. So this is a classical situation if you compare two treatments. And the next two coefficients denote the slope parameters. Beta index 3 is the slope parameter of the reference group, and beta 4 is the difference between slope parameters of the two treatment groups that you want to compare. And this is the parameter of most interest because slopes reflect the changes of a parameter under therapy and corresponds to the response of a therapy. So the difference between slopes is generally very interesting. In the end, you have the model error term, which is not independent because we are in a repeated measurement setting. And within our simulation study, we want to compare two randomized treatments. We only consider parallel group designs with a balanced treatment allocation. Now we switch to slide number 5. And here you see the sample size calculation formula we used in this project. It's the formula of Jung and Ahn 10 years ago. And I want to introduce the ingredients. This formula depends on the error term variability. Then in the next parameter, ST square, several parameters are incorporated. It's the amount of non-missing data. It's the correlation and the locations of measurement times relative to the average measurement time. Then we need to define the error probabilities. This is incorporated in the Z terms. And we come to the beta coefficient, beta for 0. I think in the paper it's beta for star because it was a little bit misleading, the 0 in the index, because it's an assumption which is under the alternative hypothesis and not under the null hypothesis. So this is the assumed treatment effect, beta for 0. And then again in the parameter mu 0, the amount of non-missing data are incorporated, and sigma r square is about the amount of balancedness within the trial. So if the treatment allocation ratio is 1 to 1, it's maximized, the variability of the treatment group indicator. And the last parameter is sigma t. That's in this parameter, the amount of non-missing data and the locations of measurement times are incorporated. So we further assume a constant risk of dropout per period, and we allow only permanent dropouts. So if a measurement is missing, it's missing for the rest observation time. We introduce a correlation model. We use a correlation model, which is called the damped exponential family of correlation structures, and this model is quite flexible because it can both model compound symmetry correlation and also autoregressive order 1 correlation and everything in between. It uses two parameters. The parameter rho is the correlation between two observations with a distance of 1 unit, and theta is the amount of decay of this basic correlation with increasing distance between measurements. Within the simulations, we assumed a significance level of 5% and a power of 80%, and now we switch to slide number 6, the re-estimation of the parameters. We choose to re-estimate the covariance matrix and the constant risk of dropout. And before, I forgot to say that the internal pilot study is defined as a fraction p of the total sample size. Re-estimating the covariance matrix is quite a complex task because we have to simultaneously estimate three parameters, rho, theta, and sigma square. We use the damped exponential family of correlation structures, and there's one further assumption. The variability of the error term is identical for all treatment groups, for both treatment groups, for all subjects, and for all measurement occasions. In the formula of Jung and Ahn, only one constant value is allowed for the variability of the error term. So we had no choice to loosen this assumption. Then we, based on the empirical covariance matrix, we applied a nonlinear model with the objective to minimize the sum of deviations between the model-based covariance metrics and the empirical covariance metric. And therefore, we needed starting values for the three parameters, rho, theta, and sigma square, and we set them to 1. Re-estimating the constant risk of dropout is a little bit more easy, and it was just derived from the rate of observed values at the last measurement time. This is displayed in the formula, so it's quite an easy calculation. And we go now to the slide number 7. After having obtained the updated estimates of the covariance parameters and risk of dropout, sample size was recalculated in a blinded way. And, of course, we used the formula of Jung et al. For this task, and we choose an unrestricted design, meaning that we have no upper sample size limit, but indirectly we had a lower sample size limit for the case that a re-estimated sample size was below the size of the internal pilot study. The analysis was performed using generalized estimating equations and in the presence of missing data, weighted estimating equations. Weights were chosen according to the inverse probability weighting method, and weights thus only differed between measurement times. Then we chose an independent working correlation metric, which is against the intuition, because any intra-subject correlation we wouldn't perform an analysis by generalized estimating equations. But there are two arguments for choosing an independent working correlation structure. The first is that the risk of convergence failure of a GEE model is minimized by this most simple correlation structure, and it is said that even though assumption is against the intuition, the model estimates for the model coefficients are quite good, so there's hardly any loss in efficiency for a certain situation if the covariates of the model are constant within the subject. So that's why we chose an independent working correlation matrix. And out of the model, we tested the hypothesis the coefficient beta index 4 is 0 at a one-sided significance level of 2.5%. Then we performed 10,000 simulation samples under the null hypothesis and also under the alternative hypothesis. Now we switch to slide number 8. I introduce the scenarios we want to investigate, and the first scenario is basic scenario with the parameter values rho equal to 0.25, theta equal to 0.5, and sigma square equal to 1. And this is modified in the scenarios 2 and 3 only by a modified size of the internal pilot study. Scenarios 4 to 8 reflect different parameter values, and in the scenarios 9 to 12, the first scenario is combined with the presence of missing data. So you have 1% or 5% has a dropout per time period, and this is combined at different sizes of the internal pilot study. Now we switch to slide number 9, and we come to the results. And at first, we want to calculate, we want to display the results of the distribution of re-estimated rho, the basic correlation. And we see that estimation of this parameter works quite well. And you see that the dashed vertical lines denote the corresponding true parameter value, which we know in this simulation. And you see that if you compare scenarios 2 and 3, which only differ by the sample size of the internal pilot study, a greater size of the internal pilot study makes the precision of the estimate better. Now we switch to slide number 10. We see the results for the re-estimated theta, the damping parameter of the correlation, and we see that estimation of theta is really difficult because there's an extreme variability, and although it is reduced, the size of the internal pilot study is increasing, it is quite difficult to estimate this theta. And you also see that you're quite often the bounds of the correlation model, 0 and 1, are hit very often, and the upper bound is even hit more often than the lower bound. And this can be explained by the next slide number 11. There you see three different covariance or correlation matrices with a constant rho of 0.5, and only the parameter theta is changed from 0 to 0.5 to 1. And within the simulation, it is possible that the empirical covariance matrix contains negative element, and the model, according to the correlation model, this is not allowed. And now, if the first line and the fourth row of the matrix is negative in the empirical correlation matrix, you see that an estimating theta equal to 1 is most close to the value 0 and thus also most close to negative values. So that's why we have a very frequent estimation of theta equal to 1. We come to the next slide now, number 12, and you see the results for re-estimated sigma square, and this is again less problematic than estimating theta, and again you see the higher the size of the internal pilot study, the higher the precision of estimates. Now we switch to slide number 13, and there you see the sample size distribution arising from the re-estimated parameters rho, theta, and sigma square. And you see that the distribution of estimates is on average near the corresponding true values. Again, the higher the size of the internal pilot study, the more precise the estimates are. Then we switch to the slide number 14, and you see the results for the type 1 and type 2 error probabilities. And for comparison, the results for the fixed sample size design are also presented. You see that the approximation formula of Jung et al. Works quite well. Nominal values of 2.5% type 1 error and power are very, very near to the nominal values. And the results for the internal pilot study are quite well too. So both type 1 error is mostly very near to the nominal value of 2.5%, and for the power near to 80%. There are some exceptions which are mostly correlated to a very low number, patient number included in the internal pilot study. Now we come to the last slide. I'll give a short summary. I think the parameters rho and sigma square are mostly unbiased. Estimation of theta is more problematic because we have a high variability and a risk of bias. And the sample size is on average near or slightly above the fixed sample size results. And the results are confirmed in the presence of missing data, which you could see on the last slide, scenarios 9 to 12. The impact of the internal pilot study size on estimates could be seen, and the type 1 error and also the power results were quite satisfactory, but we had a few limitations. The first is that the starting values for re-estimating the covariance parameters do have a great impact on the convergence probability of the model, so changed these values, and by this change the probability of convergence of the model was a little bit lower. So you have to be careful in practical situations. And we also saw that we have effects of the model-based bounds of the correlation model we used. And in a practical situation, you have to decide whether these bound effects could be a problem. And of course we have done some simplified assumptions for the simulation study, which are not common in real life applications. The most important is that the measurement times were fixed for all patients, and if this assumption is loosed, estimation could be much more difficult. So I'm at the bottom of the last slide, therefore I want to thank you for listening.
I would like to introduce my co-hosts for the presentation, from representing the statisticians in the pharmaceutical industry, is Byron Jones from Novartis, and I'll flip it over to him, Byron.
Thank you, Todd. My name is Byron Jones. I'm a a senior biomedical fellow in the statistical methodology group at Novartis, and also a member of the board of directors of PSI, representing the special interest group. So it's my particular pleasure today to be able to chair this part of the meeting, which is jointly sponsored by DIA and PSI. PSI, in case you are unaware, is a non-profit organization formed in 1977 and provides a forum for regular discussions of statistics and issues relating to the practice of statistics. Together with other European organizations, PSI is a member of the European Federation of Statisticians in the Pharmaceutical Industry. And we welcome new members. We have an annual conference, training courses, and scientific meetings, as well as an annual conference, I said. So I'll just stop now and, in fact, introduce our next speaker, who is Andrew Hartley, who has a PhD and is an Associate Statistical Science Director at PPD's Wilmington, North Carolina office. Andrew has over 7 years' experience as lead statistician and senior reviewer on clinical trials in anti-infectives, oncology, neuroscience, and metabolic disorders. Dr. Hartley received his PhD in statistics at Old Dominion University in 1997 and has a total of 13 years' experience in clinical trials, with a particular focus in longitudinal analysis, Bayesian inference, and decision analysis. So I'll stop and hand over to Andrew to lead us through his presentation. Thank you very much.
And thank you, too, Byron, for the nice introduction. Okay, very good. So I'm glad to be invited to speak with you today, and I hope this session will be useful to everyone on the phone. I want to take a few moments to introduce an innovative Bayesian method of adaptively adjusting the sample size of a clinical trial based only on a blinded interim look at the data. I will proceed quite quickly through this material, but if questions arise, I would be happy to correspond with you either at the end of the talk or afterwards. So here on slide number two are the major topics that I want to cover with you. First, I want to introduce review existing methods of unblinded and blinded adaptive sample size adjustment, and I'm calling that SSA, sample size adjustments. Then I will give some details about the blinded SSA method that I've designed, first in a fairly intuitive way and then in a more formal mathematical way. Many of you are aware that this method has been published in the Pharmaceutical Statistics Journal. However, as we proceed, I will mention a few enhancements to the method that I've developed since publishing that paper. Then I will present an overview of how the new method performs compared to standard blinded SSA approaches. And after that, I will also mention a few operating characteristics of the new approach, including such things as bias and type 1 error. Finally, I'll give an overview of how the new approach performs when data follow a t-distribution rather than the assumed normal distribution. So slide number three. The new method that I'm discussing today is useful in a clinical trial where the primary analysis follows compares two normal population means. In such a situation, the sample size is usually chosen so as to achieve a particular statistical power that's pre-specified, although it's not hopefully going to be excessive so as to waste resources or involve more patients than is ethical or prudent. And often the sample size needed to meet the trial objectives is highly uncertain because obviously we don't have a good estimate of either the mean treatment difference, which I'm calling delta here, or the within-treatment variance, which I'm calling sigma here, or both with much precision. This occurs in many trials, or perhaps even the majority of them, which is why the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, in its guidance on adaptive designs in 2010, advised that blinded SSA be considered for most trials. Slide number four. So quite a few sample size procedures have been designed and used up till now. In all of these, we start the trial with a tentative sample size target, and then we collect some on-trial data, we estimate delta and or sigma, and then we give ourselves a chance to increase the sample size. And I should mention at this point that I'm using capital letters for both delta and sigma because in the Bayesian paradigm, these are viewed as uncertain and variable. They do exist, and they are single values, but we don't know what those values are, so we can assign probability distributions to those. That's why I'm using the capital letters. Slide number 5. So both unblinded and blinded sample size adjustment methods exist, and each of these two families has both pros and cons, or pluses and minuses. The challenge of the unblinded methods are mainly logistical and technical. So we're talking about the need for a data monitoring committee, firewalls, strict confidentiality, and so forth, control the dissemination of the results. And also, these methods can complicate statistical inference at the end of the trial. However, these unblinded methods do allow precise estimations of both delta and sigma. On the other hand, the blinded methods obviate most of those logistical challenges. The idea with these is to calculate the overall blinded sample variance, which I'm calling S sub B squared here, and then these methods use that to re-estimate sigma. So I'm speaking in generalities here. Obviously, there are some methods that proceed differently, but these are how most of the blinded sample size adjustment approaches do go. So anyway, this overall blinded sample variance, S sub B squared, it usually overestimates sigma. And because of that, people usually subtract from it some kind of an adjustment term, which is approximately 1/4 times the square of the hypothesized value of delta. We come up with some value of delta we think is pretty close to the truth, and then we subtract 1/4 of that from the S sub B squared. However, because these blinded sample size methods estimate sigma only, they are recommended only when we already know delta fairly precisely. Now, throughout this presentation, I'll be comparing my method to the method of Golden Shi from 1999 with respect to a number of performance measures. So I should mention now that this is this use of S sub B squared is also what the Golden Shi method does. It only estimates sigma. Next slide, which is slide number 6. So obviously, neither the established blinded nor unblinded SSA methods are really ideal. The blinded method I'm presenting here avoids most of the logistical and technical challenges of the unblinded methods, while also improving our ability to power the study as desired compared to the other blinded methods. So here on this slide, number 6, is an intuitive, non-mathematical idea of how the new method works. First, I think we will all agree that trialists do have some impressions about the plausible values of delta and sigma. Obviously, if they didn't, then performing the trial would probably be unethical and not prudent. So let's assume that we can summarize our beliefs about these parameters using a normal distribution for delta and a gamma distribution for sigma. Slide 7. Now let's also calculate that same statistic I mentioned before, S sub B squared, which is the blinded sample variance that most established blinded sample size adjustment methods depend on. But let's think about this statistic a little bit more broadly. Now, the conditional expectation of S sub B squared, given delta and sigma, is sigma plus K delta squared, as is shown here, where the multiplier K approaches 1/4 from above, and it's fairly close to 1/4 for all values of the sample size at the interim analysis. In other words, both delta and sigma do influence S sub B squared. So it makes sense, I think, you will agree, that if S sub B squared is much bigger than what we expected it, then this suggests that either the absolute value of delta or maybe sigma, or maybe both, are larger than what we thought, what we previously estimated. Also, thinking intuitively, if we are fairly sure about the size of sigma, then a surprisingly large value of S sub B squared suggests that we've underestimated the absolute value of delta and so forth. So the larger point here is that S sub B squared does inform us about delta, and not only about sigma. So the blinded SSA approach that I'm proposing here formalizes this type of reasoning by adjusting the PDFs of both delta and sigma according to what we see in S sub B squared. So in particular, as is mentioned here, if the variance of sigma is much bigger than the variance of delta, then S sub B squared mainly shifts the PDF of sigma. So that means that we are relatively uncertain about the value of sigma, and we would allow S sub B squared to change our beliefs about sigma more than our beliefs about delta. And vice versa. If the variance of sigma is much smaller than the variance of delta, then S sub B squared mainly shifts the probability density function of delta instead. So on the next few slides, I'm going to show you how the PDF of delta changes in response to S sub B squared. And this is under the condition that these two variances are equal. So the variance of sigma equals the variance of delta. So here you can see that the PDF, here you can see how, I should say, the PDF changes when S sub B squared is 20% smaller than what we expected. The flatter curve is the prior or pre-experimental PDF, and then the more peaked one is the posterior. So the posterior is squeezed towards zero. And for comparison, the next slide shows the posterior when S sub B squared is exactly as expected. So here on slide number 9, this is when we do get S sub B squared that is exactly the value that we should have expected. And as you can see, the location of the PDF is not really changed much at all, but the plausible values of delta are squeezed. So we have a narrowing of the plausible values of the mean treatment difference. And for comparison, on this third slide, number 10, S sub B squared here is 20% higher than expected, and this shifts the PDF of delta to the right. So you should have copies of these slides, so later maybe you could take a few moments and review again how much the PDF changes, that is the posterior PDF, with this amount of quote-unquote surprise in S sub B squared. Now, to avoid operational bias in an actual trial, I should mention also that the statistician should not generate or distribute these types of figures because they could be considered partial unblinding information. Obviously, nobody involved in the trial should have any indication about what are the possible values of the mean treatment difference. Slide number 11. So I've now given you a general overview of the purpose of this blinded SSA approach and also some intuition about why we would expect it to work. So now I will turn to a more mathematical description of how to implement it and why it works. And just as a prologue here, I will mention that you will understand this method better if you first appreciate the idea of Bayesian predictive power. So probably everybody on the call here understands traditional statistical power. To calculate that, we assume particular values of the population parameters, and then we simply find the sample size that gives us the targeted power. So since traditional power is conditional upon those particular parameter values, we could call it conditional power, although within the realm of adaptive designs, sometimes conditional power unfortunately has a different meaning as well. So I'm using conditional power here to refer to any time that we are fixing the parameter values. So predictive power, on the other hand, it can be seen as a generalization of traditional power. To derive it, we calculate the traditional power for each plausible combination of the parameters, and then we integrate all of the resulting conditional powers over the parameter space. So therefore, it makes sense for this method to be called average power because it averages over the parameter space. Predictive power accounts for two levels of uncertainty, one with respect to the data given the parameters and the other with respect to the parameters themselves. And I account for these uncertainties by integrating subject to the constraint, that this sum of parameters, which I've been talking about, namely sigma plus k delta squared, equals its posterior expectation. That simplifies the integration considerably. Now, in the original paper published in 2012, I should mention that the integration took place subject to the constraint that sigma plus k delta squared equals s sub b squared itself, and that can certainly be done, but in subsequent work, I've changed that from s sub b squared to its posterior expectation, and I'll talk here in the next few slides about how those two differ. There's only a slight difference between those two approaches, but it is worth knowing, and I probably need to publish another paper to enhance it in that way, as well as some discussions that we will have in the next few slides. So slide number 12 now. In the paper in, like I said, in the paper in 2012, sigma plus k delta squared was estimated using S sub b squared itself. So here's the sketch of how I've approximated that expectation, speaking more generally and I think better using the expected value of sigma plus k delta squared rather than S sub b squared itself. I'm going to sketch out how I approximate that expectation. So anyone on the call now with a Bayesian background will know the general results concerning the posterior mean and variance of a normal population mean, which I'm calling theta here. So I'm not going to cover that in detail. You can find it in basically any introductory textbook on Bayesian statistics. What's important to note here is that in the equation of mu of x that you see down here, the posterior mean of theta, that is mu of x, is a weighted average of the prior mean and the sample mean, or of mu and x, where the weights of these two values are proportional to the sampling variance, sigma squared, and the prior variance, tau squared. So this is a very simple result and very generalizable. It's also extremely parsimonious, and it shows some insights about how Bayesian inference works. So we can apply this same type of idea, as is shown on slide number 13, to our particular situation. Remember that we've said we can summarize our prior beliefs about delta with the normal distribution and our beliefs about sigma with the gamma distribution. So therefore, the prior mean of sigma plus k delta squared is easy to obtain, as is given here. Then following the pattern of the previous slide, we can write out the posterior expectation, approximately at least, of sigma plus k delta squared. Now, I use the letters A and B for the sampling variance and the prior variance, as these variances are somewhat complicated. They would basically fill up the slide with teeny tiny print, but one can certainly derive them. And to remind you of the purpose here, just to get a little bit of a bigger picture, I'll say that now that we have an improved estimate of sigma plus k delta squared, we perform the double integration in the previous slide subject to the condition that sigma plus k delta squared equals its estimate given here. So if you didn't do that, then you would need to perform a double integration, which is quite a bit more complicated and takes much more computing time. But with this restriction, it turns out that you only need a single integration. So we perform that integration for each candidate sample size, and that gives us the corresponding predictive power for that sample size. And just a reminder, the predictive power is an average power where we are averaging or integrating over the parameter space. So once we've done that for each of the sample sizes that we are considering, then we just have to choose the sample size that gives us the predictive power that we want. So slide number 14. So to review a little, you can implement the new SSA procedure with these steps, and these are given in more detail in the paper. So step 1A is to decide whatever power you want. 1B is to summarize your beliefs about delta and sigma. 2A is to collect your interim data and calculate the blended sample variance, S sub B squared. 2B is to estimate sigma plus K delta squared using either its posterior expectation or, as was given in the paper, simply just S sub B squared. Step number 3 is then for each N being considered, calculate the predictive power, which is the conditional power integrated over the parameter space. And it's probably appropriate now to mention that it's extremely easy to do this within SAS Proc IML, or Interactive Matrix Language. That's the way I did it, using the call quad routine. So you could do that, or you could use the posterior expectation of sigma plus K delta squared. So finally, in step number 4, you select the new end-of-study sample size that comes closest to providing the predictive power you want, or you could just choose the sample size, which is the minimum that meets your particular requirements of whatever power that you pre-specify. Slide number 15, and I'm trying to move quickly here. A generalization that I added to the methodology since publishing the paper is to adjust the sample size in a blinded fashion when we are comparing R treatment groups in a standard one-way analysis of variance where R is bigger than 2. So N here is the sample size per group at the end of the study. The model here says that we can decompose the outcome into an overall mean plus a treatment-specific effect plus a normally distributed error term. And you are probably familiar, everybody on the phone, with the usual F statistic for testing the null hypothesis that all the treatment-specific effects are 0. So that's just the ratio of the mean sum of squares due to treatment divided by the mean sum of squares due to error. And to find the power of any specified sample size, then you hypothesize a particular population, sums of squares of alphas, and then you use standard statistical software to compute the critical value of the corresponding non-central F distribution. Then you just find the probability of exceeding that critical value under whatever alternative hypothesis that you think is reasonable. Slide number 16. So all that reasoning is very standard, but unfortunately, if we use that to infer our probability of actually achieving statistical significance, then we are pretending that we know the treatment effect fairly precisely, which is almost always unrealistic. So instead, I recommend integrating the conditional power, which I have described how to get, given the parameters over the parameter space as is shown here. And this gives you the predictive power, which, as I said earlier, accounts for the uncertainty of the data given the parameters, as well as the uncertainty of the parameters themselves. So next slide, slide number 17. The mechanics of that integration in the case of comparing three or more treatments are all analogous to those of comparing two treatments that I described before, except that I assume that the sum of squares of the alphas is distributed gamma. So without unblinding, we can calculate that same statistic, S sub B squared, although in the context of one-way ANOVA, this is actually the total mean sum of squares, or MSTO. This statistic has a well-known expectation conditional upon sigma plus multiple of the sums of squares of the alphas, as is shown here. M in this case is the sample size per group at the time of the interim analysis. And as with comparing only two treatments, we calculate the posterior expectation of that expression of sigma and the alphas, and the expectation is weighted average of that MSTO and the prior expectation. Everything I want to reiterate is analogous to the case of comparing only two treatments. And then we calculate the traditional power, given each potential combination of the parameters, and we integrate over the parameter space, very much as done before, and then we can do that with each candidate sample size, and finally we choose the sample size for the total trial at the end of the study that gives us the desired predictive power. So it's all very straightforward once you've done it for the case of only two treatments. So now I have covered all the theoretical developments about this new method and talked about at least one enhancement. I do want to summarize very briefly about how well this method performs compared to the established blinded sample size approaches, or sample size adjustment approaches, I should say. Now, you may be familiar with this story from Alice in Wonderland, and I don't know how much people on the European side know about this classic, but Alice is exploring a new world to her, and she came to a fork in the road, and she says, which road do I take? So the Cheshire Cat is another character, and he says, well, where do you want to go? I don't know, Alice answered. Then, said the cat, it doesn't matter. So the point I want to bring out here is that without some kind of a loss function or utility function, then the choice is between various methods, including sample size adjustment methods, are arbitrary. So we really need to decide on a loss function. And I want to take a little bit of time to describe the loss function that chose here. I could also talk about the reason that I chose this, but time does not really permit. So the objective that I used for comparing the methods is to minimize the expected loss or the risk with respect to the absolute deviation from 90% power. Obviously, 90% power is nothing special. It has no distinctive importance, but it is fairly popular in adequate and well-controlled clinical trials, so I've just been using that. So when we take expectations of this deviation with respect to both the data and the parameters, then we get a measure that I have called the mean-mean absolute deviation, or MMAD, and I use that MMAD to compare the new sample size method with the approach of Golden Shee from 1999. One could compare with other established approaches as well. However, like I said before, most of those established approaches lead to very similar sample sizes, so you're going to come up with the same basic results when you compare those to the new approach as well. So in the end, just to summarize very briefly, I found that the new method reduces the MMAD by anywhere from 15 to 27% over a wide range of parameter values. So here are some of the details of those comparisons. I won't really go through them all due to a lack of time. Slide number 21. I apologize for if I forgot to say I was changing slides before. So slide 21 now. Since publishing that paper, I've also looked at how well the new approach does in financial terms. And here we're talking about maximizing what is commonly known as risk-adjusted net present value. In the bold here on slide 21 is a decomposition of RNPV. It's the payoff if you do succeed in the trial times the probability of success minus the sampling costs. And the nice thing about the predictive power that we have calculated so far is that it does a pretty good job in estimating the probability of success, at least in simple situations. I probably need to skip over slide number 22 here to go to slide 23. So what I've done here is to describe how the various components of RNPV behave for over the range of sample sizes, and then I'm trying to think of what I should say and what I should not say due to lack of time. So the basic idea here is that if you look over the various sample sizes, costs increase fairly linearly over the sample sizes. That's in the light blue on slide 23. And then expected revenue, which is a combination or a multiple of the probability of success and the payoff if you do get success, increases quite rapidly in the beginning and then levels off. So if you subtract the expected revenue minus the expected costs, you get a curve like what is in the darker blue here, expected profit as a function of N. And in the following slides, after slide 24, So let's talk about slide a little bit, slide 24. I have graphed the risk-adjusted net present value of the new method, that is N prime prime minus the risk-adjusted net present value of N prime, all divided by the absolute value of the latter, of the risk-adjusted net present value of N prime, that is the method of golden sheep. And I did that for 125 combinations of the hyperparameters, alpha, beta, theta, and tau. So alpha and beta are the parameters for the probability density function of gamma, of sigma, which is the within treatment variance, and then theta and tau squared are the parameters of the probability density function of delta, the population mean treatment difference. So on slide 25, here's what we see when we compare the golden sheep method with the new method for this ratio of risk-adjusted net present values. So as you can see, most everything is above zero here. We do have a few values below zero, but most of those are above, indicating that the new method is effective in increasing risk-adjusted net present value. Slide 27 now. Slide 26. So I also looked at how this new method performs when data are distributed according to a t-distribution rather than the assumed normal distribution. What I found was that there was quite a bit more noise, and actually sometimes the extreme outliers possible with the t-distribution can cause both of these methods, the golden sheep method and the proposed method, to fail, because S sub B squared just becomes too large to do anything with. But still on slide 27, we do see that the proposed method does better in maximizing risk-adjusted net present value. So slide 28 here summarizes the major topics that we've covered. I just want to say that the approach that we are talking about here systematically adjusts the probability density functions of delta and sigma using the blinded overall sample variance, and it can be generalized to the case where we are comparing three or more treatments, as in a one-way ANOVA. I also showed that the new method reduces the mean-mean absolute deviation compared to the method of golden sheep, especially when delta is highly uncertain. Yes, I should probably go back to slide 25 here and talk about how the new approach also provides more of an advantage towards the right. So the ordinate here, the abscissa, is the logarithm of the ratio of the variances of delta and sigma. So towards the right, this is where the variance of delta exceeds the variance of sigma, and that's where we do see the most advantage of the new method compared to the traditional blinded sample size adjustment procedures. So back then to slide 28, and I also showed that the new method generally increases risk-adjusted net present value even when the data follow t-distributions. So I hope this presentation has been useful for you. I've tried to bring out the highlights talk about the what was found in the paper, as well as some of the enhancements and generalizations that have been developed since then. So thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I now hand over back to Tad, who will introduce our discussant, Peiling. Back to you, Tad.
Hi, this is Tad. Dr. Peiling Yang is the team leader in the Division of Biometrics 1. We're really pleased that she has agreed to join us and has even agreed and put slides together, even though there was a partial government shutdown that had the FDA folks up. So thank you, Peiling. The floor is now yours.
Because of the time constraint, let's flip slide 2 and stop at slide 3. Both papers propose blinded sample size re-estimation in different settings. One based on GEE in longitudinal studies, and the other based on predictive power, that is semi-Bayesian in cross-sectional studies. Let's move to slide 4. The GEE authors, Drs. Walking and Kieser, investigated whether a blinded sample size re-estimation is feasible in the GEE analysis setting for longitudinal studies. And I think this is a very useful research work because GEE is a commonly seen analysis. They explore this by comparing slopes where the formula for the sample size calculation was based on the closed form proposed by Yong and An. In their exploration, data were simulated based on a constant risk of dropout and a damped exponential family for the within-subject correlation. Whereas data measures the extent of decay, also known as a damping parameter. Now let's move to slide 5. Their simulation results suggest that the recalculated sample size was on average close to that from a fixed sample size design. In my view, although on average it was close to the one from a fixed sample size design, the variability of the recalculated sample size may not always be ignorable, particularly with a very small internal pilot study, as shown in next two slides. So now let's move to slide 6. In this slide, which corresponds to scenario 2 from the paper, the internal pilot study size was only 41. The recalculated sample size can be as small as 90 and as large as 310, with a range of around 220. For a fixed sample size design, the required sample size would be around 203. Now let's move to slide 7, which corresponds to scenario 5. The internal pilot study size was 112. The recalculated sample size ranged from around 130 to 300, with a range of approximately 170. For a fixed sample size design, the required N would be around 223. So now let's move back to slide 5. I have two questions here. First, I wonder if it is possible to investigate the variability of the calculated sample sizes and its impact on the study power. For example, how low could the study power become if these were the sample sizes in a fixed design? It is also possible to closely investigate the impact of internal pilot study size on the variability of recalculated sample size, although the authors already did some exploration. And these further explorations might help us gain some ideas about the maximum of the variability we can tolerate, as well as the minimum internal pilot study size we can tolerate. Now let's move to slide 8. The authors pointed out that the estimation of theta, the damping parameter, is associated with a high variability and risk of bias when the parameter value is extreme, that is, very close to 0 or 1. Although the estimation bias might also have caused the sample size distribution to be slightly skewed, does this have impact on increasing the sample size variability? If so, how much is its impact compared with the impact from the internal pilot study size? let's move to slide nine. In terms of type 1 error control, the authors expressed that the simulated type 1 error rates were mostly very near to the nominal value. The number of simulation runs was only 10,000. In my view, it needs to be much larger to adequately investigate the type 1 error control. In fact, some of the simulated type 1 error rates were relatively large, whether based on a depth design or the fixed design. I wonder if it is feasible to enhance the precision by increasing the number of runs. Let's move to slide 10. As I mentioned in the beginning, if GE is a valid primary analysis, the proposed blinded sample size recommendation should generally be informative in re-estimating nuisance parameters such that the resulting sample size is, on average, close enough to the one from the fixed design. But we would need to have good guesses of the within-subject correlation structure, working covariance structure, treatment effect, and even the dropout mechanism. It is not clear to me how any of these wrong guesses will affect the study power. It is often a challenge to adequately postulate the treatment effect, although the impact of wrong guess on this parameter may not necessarily be as serious as the misspecification of nuisance parameters. In our experience from depression trials, we found that negative trials were often largely due to over-optimistic assumption of the treatment effect rather than the variance at the design stage. Let's move to slide 11. This is the semi-Bayesian paper. In a simple case without repeated measures, the blinded sample variance depends on the unknown treatment effect and within treatment variance, as expressed by the formula here in a Bayesian framework. So, if the treatment effect is over-postulated at the design stage, the sample variance obtained at the interim look may underestimate the true variance. This would lead to an underpowered study, and this is a problem Dr. Harley tried to address in his paper. In a frequentist framework, sample size re-estimation is based on fixed values of the unknown parameters. And in this semi-Bayesian paper, Dr. Hardy proposed to borrow the Bayesian framework by incorporating the uncertainties of treatment effect and variance to the blinded sample size re-estimation. Let's move to slide 12. To be specific, he proposed to refine the prior beliefs about treatment effect and variance based on the blinded sample variance estimated at the interim look. Then, the sample size re-estimation is determined based on reaching a certain predictive power. In my view, this appears to be a reasonable approach for sample size planning at the design stage. Based on our preliminary findings from the depression trials, the observed treatment effects for those negative trials were considerably smaller in general than the postulated values at the design stage, while the postulated values differ little among those trials. Let's move to slide 13. Dr. Harvey compared his semi-Bayesian method with the Gauchy method based on a certain loss function. It's the MMAD, meaning absolute deviation, in his paper. A main difference between these methods is that the Goshi method was derived from the frequentist framework by reaching a certain conditional power. Dr. Hardy's paper suggested that the semi-Bayesian method was generally superior to the Goshi method in terms of minimizing this expected loss. In my view, although generally superior based on a certain criterion, the semi-Bayesian method also yielded a larger sample size on average. In the simulation, the average, but not the variability, of the sample size was reported. It would be good to get a sense of the variability of sample size as well as its impact. Now let's move to slide 14. In terms of type 1 error control, Dr. Hardy found evidence of small inflation of type 1 error rate. In my view, this may not look surprising because of the opportunity to adjust the prior belief about the treatment effect based on the blinded sample variance at the interim look. But I wonder if the type 1 error rate explored in this paper has the same meaning as that in the frequentist framework, where it is defined as the maximum probability of rejecting the null over all possible nuisance parameters. Regardless, it would also be interesting to explore the extent of the inflation and the scenarios where the extent of inflation would most likely occur. Now let's move to slide 15. In today's talk, Dr. Hardy illustrated a different loss function from his paper that incorporates the sampling cost, so-called RNPV. In my view, it is a good strategy for drug companies to balance between trial success rate and sampling cost, whether it's a frequentist or Bayesian approach. Regarding prior beliefs, again, the impact of running assumed prior beliefs on those comparisons is not clear to me. It may be even a challenge to adequately quantify the prior beliefs. Let's move to slide 16. In summary, both papers provide interesting approaches to blinded sample size re-estimation. I'm sure that there are situations where these approaches will be applicable respectively. For example, if the primary analysis is GEE in longitudinal trials, we may consider Dr. Zwofing and Kisser's approach. On the other hand, for an early phase trial where there is more uncertainty about parameter space, and where type 1 error control in a frequentist framework is not critical, we may consider Dr. Hardy's approach. In order to enhance the utilities of these approaches, perhaps the following areas may be further explored if feasible. One is the impact of wrong assumptions about parameters. Another is the likelihood and impact when the recalculated sample size falls at the lower end of the sample size distribution. The third one is whether it is possible to enhance the precision when evaluating type 1 error rate. The next slide is my final slide. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Pei-Ling. We have a few minutes left for questions. Please, when you ask a question, unmute your line and identify yourself and your organization, because the call is being recorded. I'm going to kick it over to my co-host, Byron Jones, to start the Q&A.
Thank you, Stan. I think you've just given instructions on how to make a call in to ask a question. So I'm ready to take the first question. Unmute your line by pressing star 6, and wait till the time moves and then please ask your question. So Andrew, in the planning stages of clinical trial, I mean, how does predictive power differ from traditional statistical power? So when we're planning, what would you take into account? Because I think we're familiar with the rules for an experience of using what we call traditional power. And we're in this new setting of a semi-Bayesian approach with the need for priors. And how will we plan the trial?
Thank you, Byron. That's a good question. Well, the first thing to know, I believe, is that predictive power will differ from traditional power to the extent that, number one, the probability of the treatment effect is spread out away from the assumed treatment effect used in the power calculation for the traditional approach. So the more spread out is your belief, then the more difference is possible between predictive power and traditional power. Number two, it's also going to differ to the extent that the power function around that region is nonlinear. So if it was linear, then probably you would still get predictive power and conditional power to be very, very similar. But what we do see is that the power function around that point is concave down in almost every case, and that implies that the predictive power for a given sample size is less than the traditional power. So this becomes clear when we realize that because of the concavity down, the power is higher than that power at the point in the middle are not high enough to compensate for the powers lower than that to the left in the abscissa. So if the power function were linear, like I said, then you would usually get very very similar answers there. So as far as the question or the aspect of gaining understanding of the probability distributions of the parameters, what I would say is that it takes a lot of honesty, and that is what makes statistics a human enterprise. It's not just a matter of plugging in values and doing everything mechanistically. We definitely have to summarize the evidence fairly, such as the data that you're borrowing from previous trials. You have to be very forthright and transparent about how much you think those previous data will apply to the current situation of the trial that you are planning. I hope that that addresses some of your concerns or questions.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
I have a question for Daniel. Daniel, have you investigated with your procedure unequal randomization, say 2-to-1 randomization, you know, favoring the active over the control?
Can you repeat the question?
Have you investigated unequal randomization of patients to treatment groups, say twice as many to the active treatment compared to the control?
Okay, we only investigated balanced designs, but in theory. So of course, due to sampling variation in the simulations, the treatment groups were not balanced always, but the planned treatment allocation was always the same. So only balanced treatments.
Okay, thank you, Daniel. Next question, please.
Hello. Hi, I have another question on the Dr. Hartley's paper.
Okay. Who are you,
please? This is George Kordzahi. I work for FDA. Yes, I was just curious, in your paper, in the computation of the conditional power, did you use the... So it was based on the observed data, or so you use the first you estimate the sample size based on your method, and then use the true, for instance, parameters that to compute the power for table one.
Yes, I'm pulling up table one.
For instance, these conditional. When talking about conditional power, did you use like when you observe S squared? Well, you get the posterior distribution, and then you compute the predictive power, conditional power. But then, was the the power, actual power, was observed based on the observed the parameters like the S square or. So did you use S square to recompute the sample size and then estimated the power based on the true parameter values, or the numbers given there are based both on the only on observed S square.
Right, sure. I think your question is very clear, and that's a good question. These are all based on the actual results of the simulated trials. So I calculated the proportion of trials in which we did have a statistically significant result in the end.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? I think we have just about a minute left. Last chance, folks.
Mm-hmm.
I think in her slides, Pei Ling has pointed out some thoughts that one might have if one were to apply these techniques. I think the techniques themselves are really useful. Certainly blinded sample size re-estimation offers some good opportunities that you do not see with the unblinded versions of these. And even the unblinded ones still have potential issues because you are observing, you are basing some results based on observed data. Even though it may be unblinded, it's still going to be measured with variability, not to mention the issues of bias and the problems with operational issues. So I think that these unblinded techniques are really useful. I really appreciate the fact that folks on the other side of the ocean in our colleagues in PSI have joined us for this joint teleconference. I think it's been really useful. I want to point out that the teleconference is going to be archived on the DIA website, but you'll need to visit the PSI website and the DIA website fairly soon if you want to download the papers, because the papers themselves are subject to copyright laws according to the publishers of both of the journals. So those papers themselves will only be available for a short time if you don't have the journal itself, whereas the presentations, including Pei Ling's latest set of slides, will be on the DIA website, as well as ultimately the taped version of today's presentations. I want to thank everybody for joining us. Again, I want to thank PSI. And a special thanks to the DIA, and we hope to see you again at the, or to hear from you, particularly at the next Virtual Journal Club. Thank you very much.